Good morning.
Ms. Johnson.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Roxanne Mendez-Johnson, and I represent Devon Groves. Here, Defense Counsel May was ineffective when he failed to object to the erroneous characterization of Mr. Groves' 1995 burglary conviction.
Counsel, you told us in your brief here, and are repeating at oral argument, one thing you say counsel did not do. What did counsel do? We keep saying, indeed the Supreme Court keeps saying, ineffective assistance requires an evaluation of the total course of the representation. Your brief, as I read it, pays no attention to what counsel did for Groves, and therefore doesn't even begin to meet the Supreme Court standards, which say evaluate the whole course of representation.
Your Honor, the Supreme Court has stated that the entire course of representation includes, specifically, in Lafler and Frye.
It includes everything.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you haven't tried to evaluate everything. You have absolutely ignored everything the lawyer did with the exception of this one omission.
Your Honor, he's made two omissions in our brief. We've discussed the issue in sentencing that is referred to by the Supreme Court in DeCamp, as well as the Lafler issue where he failed to review a plea agreement with his client, which is per se prejudice. Going back to the DeCamp argument, Your Honor, Mr. May objected. Actually, he did not object, and that was the problem.
You haven't dealt with my question. Are you asserting that you can just ignore everything else counsel did? That would require us to conflict with the Supreme Court, overrule a whole bunch of our own decisions.
Your Honor, I agree that the totality of counsel's
Yes, that's
review.
The standard.
Yes, Your Honor.
You must also agree that your brief makes not the slightest effort to examine the totality of counsel's work for Groves.
That is correct, Your Honor. We focus on the two issues that we found were lacking, particularly pretrial at the plea negotiation stage, where he failed to discuss a viable plea agreement that was available to Mr. Groves. He failed to mention it whatsoever. In fact, he refused to describe or discuss a plea. And in Lafler and Frye, the Supreme Court both stated that this is something that all defense attorneys must do. They must engage in plea negotiations.
Is there any evidence in the record that May was even aware of this plea agreement?
Your Honor, Attorney May's testimony conflicts itself. At the evidentiary hearing, he said both that he saw no plea agreement whatsoever, and he also stated that if he did see a plea agreement in the file, he paid it no attention, it didn't bother him, he didn't review it, he didn't speak to Mr. Groves about the plea agreement whatsoever. So it is unclear, because Mr. May
How
himself...
How is that unclear that Mr. May actually had or saw a copy of the plea?
Well, Your Honor...
And in fact, the district court judge found that Mr. Knowles never received a copy back from your client.
That is correct, but the
suggesting it's not in the file for Mr. May to know about it.
That is correct, Your Honor. However, the testimony of Attorney Kowals was very clear in that there was a plea agreement in that file when he handed it off to Attorney May, and that the testimony also was very clear that there was no reason for him to remove that plea agreement, and that plea was a viable plea. It was still available. It was still open. It was not rescinded. Therefore, that there's a conflict there. And of the two attorneys, Attorney Kowals is certainly the more credible in that his information was consistent. It did not conflict upon itself.
What suggestion did your client ever give to Mr. May or to the district court that he did not want to proceed to trial?
He, with Attorney May, in the evidentiary hearing, my client did testify that he tried to speak with Attorney May several times. And he had previously, with Attorney Kowals, asked about a plea, asked about a sentence computation, which was given, which was received. Additionally, there was witness testimony at the evidentiary hearing from Jennings, who was a fellow inmate there, who testified that they discussed a plea at length. And in fact, Mr. Jennings suggested to Mr. Groves that this was a good plea and he would be wise to take it. They had extended conversations.
Did Mr. Groves ever express that to the district court? And we know he didn't hesitate to write the district court when he wanted to or convey something to the district court. Did he ever convey to the court that he did not want to go to trial?
I don't believe he conveyed directly to the district court in the form of a letter, no, Your Honor.
Or anything else to the district court, not just a letter, but verbally or otherwise.
I don't believe there is any indication, Your Honor.
And didn't he object to his speedy trial rights being violated and want a trial sooner rather than later?
Your Honor, that is also correct, but he did fluctuate back and forth. At times he said he wanted a trial. At other times he stated he wanted a sentence computation. This is not uncommon for most clients, but the duty of the attorney remains the same. Whether an attorney is the first, the fourth, or the 15th in a case, they owe their client the duty of effective representation during the plea negotiation stage. When you come into a case mid-range, the duty includes determining whether or not there is a plea that is available to the client and speaking with the client and or the United States attorney to determine where things are regarding a plea. None of that occurred here, Your Honor. In fact, Attorney May was very explicit that he did no such thing. And that is an error. That is a violation of the Supreme Court's mandate in Lafler that plea negotiations must be engaged in with their clients, with all clients. Your Honor, regarding the failure, it's per se prejudice. The fact that attorney may refuse to discuss a plea agreement with Mr. Groves, either discuss the one that was present in the plea agreement, or if there wasn't one available, why didn't he begin that discussion with Groves or with the U.S. attorney? We have to remember that it is the attorney that owes the duty of being effective towards the client, not the other way around. And that is May's failure here when he affirmatively refused to engage in any plea negotiations or discussions or inquiry whatsoever. Regarding the sentencing issue in De Camp, the documentation provided here to this court shows very clearly that Mr. Groves was sentenced to burglary C, which in Indiana is burglary of a structure. Structures include things like trucks and sheds and enclosed fences surrounding.
Camps was decided in 2013, and Groves was sentenced in May 2007. Have we ever held that an attorney rendered ineffective assistance by failing to anticipate a Supreme Court decision that lay 6 years in the future?
No, Your Honor, but if I may answer, De Camp is a reaffirmation of the holdings of Taylor, which state that the categorical approach must be used when evaluating potential predicate priors for...
Taylor did not create the divisibility doctrine. It was created, if it was created anywhere, in this circuit in 2009 in the Woods case. But that case came 2 years after the defendant's sentencing.
Your Honor, the Taylor, Shepard, which occurred in 2005, and also was a reaffirmation.
The first time the word divisibility appears in the U.S. reports is in Des Camps.
And, Your Honor, it's our belief and our position that there is no divisibility here. That's the issue that is being confused.
I understand that's your position, but that's with the benefit of 6 years of hindsight.
Your Honor,
has the Supreme Court in any way indicated that Des Camps is retroactive on collateral review?
Not at this point, Your Honor.
No.
However, it is clear that burglary C is not a crime of violence and should not be used against my client in that way. Your Honor, we would ask that this court find that there's no excuse for the failure to review the plea agreement with Mr. Groves, that it was per se prejudice. Remand is required here, and the remedy is to remand the case to vacate the conviction and allow Mr. Groves to accept the plea agreement that was offered and available to him at this time. If there's no questions at this time, I will reserve the rest for rebuttal. Thank you.
Certainly, counsel. Mr. Barrett.
May it please the court, Jesse Barrett for the United States. I think it's important, as Your Honor indicated when defense counsel began her argument, to locate where we are in the Strickland world. Mr. May was not an attorney who didn't function as the type of an attorney that the Sixth Amendment requires. Mr. May successfully objected to two guidelines enhancements and successfully reduced Mr. Groves' guideline range by a significant number of months. And he actually did object to the underlying criminal conviction that's here on appeal. He objected to it on a different ground. He objected to it because Mr. Groves had committed it as a juvenile, and so he put the government to its proof of showing that this juvenile conviction actually counted as an adult conviction because it was an adult court. So Mr. May identified the issues, was successful on two of them, and made a good argument on a third. And in doing that, he emphasized facts that were sympathetic to Groves. This prior offense was done when he was 17. He chose not to emphasize the fact that Mr. Groves, at 17, had committed a burglary very similar to the burglary for which he was in front of the court in 2007. So as an initial matter, this is, in the Strickland world, we're not in the realm of a counsel doing nothing. We're in the realm of a counsel being very active and picking his choosing and his battles and being successful on some of them. I think it's also important to note that two other attorneys agreed with Mr. May on the crime of violence issue. Mr. Kowals indicated in his note to Mr. Groves that's in the appendix that he would look into whether this burglary conviction was a juvenile conviction that should count. He didn't at all indicate that he would challenge it on the basis that it wasn't a crime of violence because it was a burglary of something besides a dwelling. Similarly, when this case came here on appeal, the third attorney, Mr. Rooney, didn't make the argument under plain air review that Judge Miller got it wrong when he said that this was a crime of violence. While that issue wasn't raised in the district court, Mr. Rooney certainly could have raised it on plain air review. So we have two attorneys who agree with Mr. May, as well as Judge Miller, who obviously found on after the habeas petition was filed that Mr. May got it right. So on the one side, we have Mr. May functioning as the type of counsel the Sixth Amendment requires under the language of the Strickland cases, and Mr. May being agreed with by the two other attorneys who handled Mr. Groves' case and being agreed with by the district court judge. So I think that it's important to look at that surrounding realm of information, and as Your Honor suggested, not just to focus on the one argument Mr. May didn't make. And also in 2007, it was not as clear as it is today, either in the Seventh Circuit or in the Supreme Court, what exactly it meant when a defendant pled guilty to a different crime.
One might think it's still not clear. Jess Camps is not self-defined.
And clearly, as you know, recently as 2009 in the Woods case, there was the dissent and the majority and trying to interpret Taylor. In Judge Bauer's Jackson case, a bit earlier
Jackson
than that.
Jackson is the court's case. I just was the author.
Okay. Well, in that case, in that opinion, there again was some questioning about under Taylor what we can look at when a defendant has pled guilty to a different crime than that with which he was charged. So it wasn't a clear-cut case for Mr. May, and there is significant Seventh Circuit case law saying that the court can look to the charging documents. I think Ms. Mendez-Johnson may be right. In 2014, most of those cases involved divisible statutes, but none of those cases limited its inquiry to divisible statutes, and as the court pointed out in the prior colloquy, the word divisible wasn't even bandied about then. Turning to the question of whether the plea offer was communicated sufficiently to Mr. Groves, It's clear Mr. Groves knew there was a plea offer. It's clear Mr. Groves didn't want the plea. He fired Attorney Kowals because Attorney Kowals said, you should take this plea. This is not a case where a defendant didn't hear about a plea agreement. It is clear that Mr. May did not communicate to Mr. Groves that there was a plea, whether because Mr. May didn't know about it or for some other reason. But I think it is important to note that the district court, Judge Miller, did deem Mr. May to be a credible witness. So I think we can take at face value that Mr. May didn't know there was a plea offer. But irrespective of that issue, there's no law that requires a substitute counsel after a defendant has already made a decision to revisit every decision he's ever made. Do you want to go to trial? What witnesses do you want? Are you sure you don't want to go back and, you know, refile a suppression motion? The rule that Groves argues for here would require a substitute counsel to essentially relitigate whatever has been litigated to that point, and that's not what Lafler or Frye or any other precedent requires. So the United States would ask the court to affirm, and if there are no further questions, I think I'm done. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Anything further?
Thank you. 2 points. Here in this particular instance regarding the plea issue, there was a deteriorating relationship between Attorney Kowals and Mr. Groves. And that is the circumstance under which Mr. May entered into the picture. Certainly in that particular instance, it is the duty of an entering attorney to review the situation and figure out the status quo of the pleas. Is there a plea available? Has plea negotiation occurred? What's going on? But that did not happen here.
What law says that you have to do that?
Your Honor, under Supreme Court's decision in Lafler, it was per se prejudice for an attorney not to discuss a plea agreement with
Supreme Court in Lafler expressly rejected any argument that it was per se a violation. They laid out a fairly complicated test for what prejudice is. And, of course, Lafler didn't say there was any obligation to press a plea offer on somebody who said he didn't want to plead guilty.
And that's
was just never before the Supreme Court.
Your Honor, I see my time is up.
You can always answer a judge's question.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, in this particular instance, the fact that after a contentious relationship, not establishing what the plea circumstance was prejudicial. And therefore, we'd ask that this court remand and vacate the conviction and allow Mr. Groves to take the plea that was offered to him and viable at the time it reached Mr. May's hands.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Mendez-Johnson, the court appreciates your willingness to accept the appointment in this case, which is now taken under advisement.
Thank you.
The court will be in recess.